And I'm proud of you.
Well, that was my conversation with Lucy Kavavauk. She's originally from Arctic Bay. That's in the high Arctic, up in Nunavut. I would like to remind you that as Inuit like Lucy, we continue to advocate for our language, as our fellow Indigenous friends all over the world are doing as well. Before we head off for another week, today's word is Inuktitut. That is our language. Inuktitut. Inuktitut. The language of the Inuit. Inuit. We are Inuit. 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 But I am one person. I am Inuk. Inuk. I am Inuk. I'm Madeline Alakirelek for Words and Culture. Atsunai.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin. Soko seni denit e. Ninen yuji hina.
Ekose.
Kakuhutau. We'll see you again.
CFRC from Kingston, Ontario. Your volunteer program, campus and community radio at 101.9 FM and on the web at cfrc.ca.
Good afternoon, everyone. It is now 5 o'clock here at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. You are listening to Campus Beat. I'm Dinah Jansen. In this program, the CFRC news team welcomes new guests from the Queen's University community and covers news, issues, upcoming and recent events, initiatives, and services for the benefit of Queen's University students, faculty, staff, and alumni. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to Campus Beat. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me today is CFRC Campus News reporter Ali Al-Safidi. Today, we bring you campus news headlines and information about the upcoming AMS trustee elections and student fee referenda featuring interviews with trustee candidates. But first, our top story from Queen's University today. Principal Patrick Dean has announced that Health Sciences Dean Dr. Jane Philpott will step down from her leadership role to become chair of the Primary Healthcare Action Team. Principal Dean announced that Dean Jane Philpott will be taking a new role with the Ontario government effective December 1st, 2024. She will be stepping down as the Dean of Queen's Health Sciences to chair and lead a new primary care action team. Earlier this year, Dean Philpott announced her intention not to seek a second term as Dean to focus on her commitment to improving healthcare systems. In the provincial announcement, Health Minister Sylvia Jones says Dr. Philpott will be leading efforts to connect every person in Ontario with primary health care. In his announcement, Principal Dean also said that he will be naming an interim dean of health sciences shortly. The search process for a permanent dean is well underway. A principal's advisory committee to support the search was established in July, and it has identified a short list of candidates. Interviews are expected to be scheduled in November, with a new dean to be in place by July 1st, 2025. During her time as dean, Dr. Philpott led the creation of a new admissions process that improves equitable access to the faculty's MD program. And in 2023, she led the expansion of a partnership with the Winnebago Area Health Authority to launch a program to prepare Indigenous students for healthcare careers with support from the MasterCard Foundation. Under her leadership, the faculty developed an innovative educational and training partnership between Queen's and Lake Ridge Health to address family physician shortages in southeastern Ontario. In June, she announced a transformational gift from Murray and Kara Sinclair that will significantly advance cancer research at Queen's University. The $25 million gift will help the university build research capacity in an area of existing strength, establish advanced facilities, create training opportunities, and work to improve cancer care and treatments locally, nationally, and around the world. For the time being, Stephen Vanner has been officially appointed as the interim dean effective December 1st, 2024. In other campus news, the Ministry of Labour has issued a no-board report amid efforts to renew the collective agreement between Queen's University and PSAC 901 Unit 2. Ontario's Ministry of Labour has issued a no-board report as efforts continue to try and reach an agreement to renew the collective agreement between the university and PSAC 901, which represents a bargaining unit of postdoctoral fellows, PSAC Unit 2, employed by Queen's University. The no board report issued on Saturday, October 26th, means that members of the PSAC Unit 2 bargaining unit may legally strike, and the university may legally lock out the employees in that bargaining unit at 12:01 a.m. on Tuesday, November 12th. This does not mean a work stoppage will necessarily occur on or after that date. The university and PSAC Local 901 have been meeting since October 2023 in efforts to renew the Unit 2 collective agreement, which expired on June 30, 2023. In August, Queen's University asked the Ministry of Labour to appoint a conciliator to assist the parties in reaching an agreement. The parties' representatives met with the conciliator present on two dates in October that were scheduled for conciliation. The discussion ended at midnight on the second date without an agreement being reached. The university then requested the no board report on October 21st, 2024. It is a normal feature of the labour relations process in the province of Ontario. Once a tentative agreement is reached, the details will remain confidential until it is ratified successfully by both parties. Moving on, in other campus news, Norma Barrett has joined Queen's University as the new ombudsperson. The start of the 2024-25 academic year brought new leadership to the Office of the University Ombudsperson effective October 1st. Norma Barrett has been appointed. In this role, Barrett will lead the OUO team in continuing to provide impartial and confidential guidance to Queen's University community members on matters of procedural fairness. She will act as an essential resource in the fair and equitable resolution of disputes, as well as the strengthening of institutional structures and decision-making processes. Most recently, Barrett served as the Senior Director, Student Conduct and Care in the Division of Student Affairs. She joined Queen's University in 2019 as the Director of the Student Conduct Office, with promotion to Senior Director in the summer of 2022. In these roles, Barrett actively worked to strengthen processes and procedures for the fair resolution of complaints under the Student Code of Conduct, Harassment and Discrimination Prevention and Response Policy, and the Policy on Sexual Misconduct and Sexual Violence Involving Students. In that time, Barrett also served the broader university community as a member of the Ombudsperson Advisory Committee and more recently as chair of the Sexual Violence Policy Implementation Working Group. Prior to joining Queen's, Barrett served as a member of the Canadian Armed Forces as a logistics officer, followed by selection for the Military Legal Training Plan and graduation from Queen's Law in 2011. Barrett completed her military career as a legal advisor with responsibilities for oversight of military justice operations in Trenton. During her military career, she received recognition for her dedication and commitment to fairness in administrative legal matters. And now moving over to Ali Al-Safidi with coverage on the upcoming Alma Mater Society trustee elections and student fee referenda taking place October 30th and 31st.
Hello everyone, I'm Ali, CFRC's campus news reporter, and welcome to this special segment on the AMS elections happening this fall. As the campaigning period kicks off, undergraduate trustee candidates and clubs up for referenda are actively sharing their platforms, reaching out to students, and making their voices heard on issues they see as priorities. This period is all about connecting with us, the students, so we can understand who these candidates are and what they'd bring to AMS leadership. This year, undergraduate trustee candidates are highlighting key topics such as enhancing student services, supporting academics, and fostering campus inclusivity. All these areas are impacting our daily lives here at Queen's. One of the central roles in this election is the undergraduate student trustee. It's the position responsible for representing student interests and the student body as a whole on Queen's University's Board of Trustees. This year, we have three candidates, each bringing their unique perspectives on issues that center around university funding, student housing, as well as Queen's relationship with the broader Kingston community. Throughout their campaigns, candidates have shared their platforms, which highlight how they plan to amplify our voices on the Board of Trustees, demonstrating their commitment to representing student interests if elected. This election isn't just about individual candidates. It's also when students decide on club referenda. These votes determine which clubs will receive funding to continue offering the services and events we all benefit from academic societies to social and support organizations. The clubs up for referenda are an essential part of student life here at Queen's. Remember to check the AMS Elections website for more information on how to cast your vote to ensure that your voice is heard. Up next, I'll be speaking with EJ Kelvin, one of our undergraduate trustee candidates. EJ will share insights into her platform, her vision, and goals for representing students. Let's get into it. Hi, EJ. Thank you for joining me here today. Can you please introduce yourself and highlight some key leadership experiences you've had that have prepared you for this election?
Hi, everyone. My name is EJ Kelvin. I'm a first-year Con Ed student. I was a student trustee for the Algonquin and Lakeshore Catholic District School Board here in Kingston. So I represented students in the regional level, but also on the provincial level. And then I'm currently also the Chief Operating Officer of the Ontario Student Trustees Association, where I manage the day-to-day tasks for student trustees and help them and provide them with the professional development that they need to best serve their students.
Thank you, EJ. That's actually very impressive. I just have a question. Can you please elaborate more on the values that are driving your decision to run for the undergraduate trustee position?
So my campaign has three main pillars, and they're transparency, community, and student support. And so with transparency, I believe that knowledge is power. It sounds very cliche, but I think that there's no way to enact change unless you're informed and you have the necessary information that you need. And so I think that it's very important for students to know exactly what's going on. If I'm elected, I'm elected by the undergraduate student body, and so I want them to know exactly what it is that's going on and what's happening on the board level. And then for community, I think that since COVID, there's been a decrease in student involvement and student engagement, and so I'd like to work with the AMS and faculty societies to help introduce small, low-cost events that can help students feel as though they're part of the Queen's community and feel engaged. And then going hand-in-hand with that, I'd like to raise money with these events to offer bursaries for students and support them through any unexpected costs that they may experience, because life sometimes throws you curveballs and you need to be able to fight those. And so with these low-cost events, hopefully we can raise money to offer bursaries to students who really deserve and need them.
Just following up on that, how are you making your campaign accessible, and how can students reach out to you to learn more about your platform and the three pillars you just mentioned?
So I just got approved to make my Instagram public, so I have my election Instagram page that I've started, and I'm going to be posting hopefully every day and keeping students updated with exactly who I am, because I want people to see my personality and not just see, oh, she wants to run, but I want people to understand the type of person I am and vote for me because of what I can do for them. And I want people to be able to relate to me as a student. So I've opened an Instagram account, and I'm going to be also, I have my emails open if people have any questions or ideas for my campaign, anything that they want to see happen in the school that I am able to do in my term as a student trustee. I want to hear from people.
Thank you, EJ, for this interview. I wish you luck in your elections. Please make sure to check out her Instagram at EJ4StudentTrustee and ask her any questions and check out her campaign.
Thank you so much for having me.
As we approach the election days, be sure to familiarize yourself with all the clubs that are running to establish new free referendums, including the Armenian Student Association, Q-Wave, and Women in Science and Engineering. Consider how these groups enrich student life on campus, and remember that your vote directly supports the valuable services and opportunities they provide. Now, let's hear it from our next undergraduate trustee candidate, Zain Al-Sudani, who will share his insights and tell us more about his goals if elected as the undergraduate trustee. Hi, Zain. Can you further introduce yourself and highlight some experiences you've had that have prepared you for this campaign and election?
So yeah, like I said, hi, my name is Zain Al-Sudani. I'm a first-year computing student. And before that, I was also one of the peer leaders of TNO, Toronto Neighborhood Organizations. I was the one that made the first newcomers club in my school, highlighting and supporting newcomers that had to deal with war experiences or anything in that kind of a way. I also was my robotics team team leader for the sections that I was leading, and as well from I led a certain section in my NASA team, which we made it somehow far, but still didn't win. But yeah.
That's actually very interesting. Moving on to the other question, what values do you believe a student leader should uphold, and how will these guide your actions?
Well, in the cases, for me, in my opinion, it's knowing how to deal with honesty. You were set in that position to make a difference. And even if you're not achieving that difference, you should, at the end of the day, still include everybody into the decisions. I believe that I have nothing to lose if I would be in that position, but how I define leadership is the responsibility to communicate and to give straight up directions. I made promises and I am here to hold them. But I am also aware that if I didn't make those promises or I cannot hold them, I have to be 100% transparent.
Thank you for that. I truly respect that. I really believe that a lot of the students, such as myself, believe that transparency is a great value to hold as a student leader. And just following up on your previous answer, what role do you think the undergraduate trustee should play in addressing EDII-A plus concerns on our campus, in the university, and in our communities in general?
That's a very good question. My own way, how I want to run the position or the promises that I'm bringing, one of them, a huge point of it, is diversity and, in general, supporting those groups. I believe that not only every kind of diversity, also the international students in Queens are underrepresented. When you come, as I came here to Queens, the first thing I heard from even teachers is, don't go there, it's racist. I want to take away that image. I want to make more a community where people would say, hey, I want to go to Queens, not because of those things. I want to go to Queens because I want to make something out of myself. And just like I had to go through many ups and downs in my life, I believe that Queens has that too. So the role how I can support that is by giving them more space, opening more options for them to speak up, more opportunities for, in general, like having many parties or any gatherings, increasing the committees that speak up for that and give more fundings for those who cannot speak up so that we can speak up for them.
Yeah, I really appreciate that as well. So just following up, what actions or what do you hope to achieve if you're elected that would represent these that things that you just mentioned, like making Queens more diverse, as well as just some other things you hope to achieve as the undergraduate trustee?
Well, yeah, I'm going to talk about that in a bit, of the things that I want to like achieve in general. But the first action that I'm going to set with is making people aware of that position. I got aware not a long time ago that many people, even second and even in third year, don't even know what that position is. I need them to understand that that position exists and it has a certain amount of power. Making people aware of that makes them also aware of the opportunities they have. I want to decrease the distance between me and the people. I want them to really understand that I'm just a student as well and that we can put that all together. My first action is going to be to genuinely go to each of those clubs that have those diverse communities within them and then ask them, what's the problem? How can I help? And what can we do right now? Those are the three questions that I would like to ask and really sitting down with them to see if it's maybe the money or maybe the awareness or whatever that is. Setting up a network between each of those communities, making more outside gatherings, making people more aware of those communities, which can also help. I also would like to add more social media and social media in general. I would like to more make more transparency when it comes to the decisions I'm making, what I'm changing, what I'm doing. I want to add people to it, make votes, like let them decide what the best choice is and what I should do. After that, for the big decisions that I'm doing, and I'm aware that those decisions might not be done within my period of residing in that position, but it would be, for example, into increasing the stadium, the capacity of the stadium, which automatically would mean more money, and that more money means more advertisement, which can go into many of those other clubs that would need it, for example, or the people. Which brings me to my last point of the main. I have, of course, more than that, but my most important one, in my opinion, is the grants. I was never the one that had the money. I had to fight really hard to get into that position. And to be honest, without OSEP, I wouldn't be even here. So I'm aware that people struggle, and I don't want them to ask themselves, am I going to buy the new laptop to do my assignments, or am I going to pay my rent? I want them to worry about their academics and about everything surrounding that. So I would like to increase the grants for people, make the system more better to choose who really needs it and who doesn't. And I would like to help out some of the clubs.
Thank you so much, Zain, for joining me. It was great talking to you, and I wish you luck in the upcoming elections.
Thank you so much.
With the AMS elections underway, it's important to consider the impact of the binding referendum question on this fall's ballot. The question asks, do you agree that the Alma Mater Society should join the Canadian Alliance for Student Associations as an observer for the 2024-2025 school year? Joining CASA will enhance the AMS's advocacy efforts at the federal level. CASA has successfully lobbied for key issues, like the removal of interest on Canadian student loans, as well as increased investments in student grants. This observer membership will provide Queen's students with access to a network that supports our interests and amplifies our voices in government. This membership is not just about joining a larger organization, it's about ensuring that our needs and concerns are heard and addressed at all levels of government. By supporting this referendum, we can strengthen our advocacy and have a more significant influence on policies that directly affect our university experience. Now let's turn our attention to our final undergraduate trustee candidate. Unfortunately, she couldn't join us, but Siham Kitane is a first-year joint honors student in global development and political studies. Siham mentions that her personal journey as a Muslim Palestinian woman navigating systemic barriers has fueled her passion for inclusive leadership. She aims to amplify student concerns through actionable solutions, focusing on delivering measurable outcomes. This includes advocating for an increase in budget allocation for arts and science programs, expanding international student transition services, and prioritizing campus safety with biannual audits of key facilities. Siham is committed to creating a campus where every student voice is heard, and where positive, measurable change is the norm. For more information about her platform, and to ask her questions, make sure to check out her Instagram at Siham4Trustee. As we wrap up this segment on the AMS elections, it's essential to remember that your voice matters, and it can significantly impact our campus community. In addition to the candidates and the binding referendum questions, there is also an important triennial fee referendum on the ballot that you should be aware of. Make sure to review all the candidates and referenda before casting your vote. Just a reminder that voting is open from the 30th to the 31st. Your participation is crucial in shaping a Queen's that reflects our values and meets our needs. Thank you for joining me here today, and don't forget to stay informed and engaged throughout the election period.
The Alma Mater Society invites all AMS members to vote on October 30th and 31st in the fall referendum. Visit myams.org or at AMS Governance on Instagram for more information about your ballot and watch your Queen's email for voting instructions. Have your voice heard. Get out and vote on October 30th and 31st in the AMS fall referendum at Queen's University.
Applications for Cohort 10 of the Pathy Foundation Fellowship are now open. The Pathy Foundation Fellowship is an intensive, 12-month experiential learning opportunity for graduating students to lead a self-directed project in a community they have a meaningful connection with. Fellows are provided with comprehensive training, personal and professional development coaching, $40,000 in funding, and wraparound supports to design, plan, and implement an innovative project in their community. Submit your application today at www.pathyfellowship.com.
Help CFRC serve our community listeners. Have your voice heard and share your thoughts through our online listenership survey. Visit CFRC.ca, click on the link, and take the 3 to 4 minute survey. All participants can enter for a chance to win great prizes from Smokes Poutinerie and Uber Eats. Your voice matters. Make it heard by taking the CFRC listenership survey today via CFRC.ca. Thank you for your support. And thank you to CFRC Campus News reporter Ali Al-Safidi for his wonderful very first report here on CFRC covering AMS elections and referenda. Indigenous students on campus are reminded that tonight at 6 o'clock, you can head over to Four Directions for 4D Peer Mentor Game Night, a social event featuring lots of awesome board games, Nintendo Switch games, and yummy food happening until 8 o'clock. Graduate students and their friends are also reminded that from 2 to 4 p.m. on Friday, November 1st, the 2024 National 3MT, that is the 3-Minute Thesis Showcase, will be recorded and live streamed to a public audience. The platform is using Zoom, but you can register to get the link via the SGS. You can support your Queens and Ontario representative, Julia Tropak, from the Department of Chemistry as she delivers her 3MT talk. The top two People's Choice nominees will then go on to represent Canada at the North American 3MT Showcase in December in St. Louis, Missouri. And all students, whether AMS or SGPS, are advised that you can drop in for career advising between Monday to Thursday at 1 to 2 p.m. at the Career Services Office. And there are also opportunities for international students, specifically on Tuesday and Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m., also through Career Services. And thank you for tuning into Campus Beat right here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Stay tuned for more amazing news, spoken word, and musical news programming. Don't forget to support CFRC this November and December during our annual funding drive. You can donate today via CFRC.ca and support critical station operations, our news programming, and our creative programming that supports local artists. It's been a pleasure. We'll see you next time.
Keep up with what's hot on CFRC Airwaves. Find us today on Instagram and Facebook. Follow us at CFRC Music and keep your finger on the pulse of Kingston's best music mix.
After an eventful quarterfinal game, your Queens Gaels are still running down a dream. And on Saturday, November 2nd, they come face to face with the number one ranked, undefeated Wilfrid Laurier Golden Hawks. The stakes are high and the odds are stacked against the Gaels, but this is a team that makes the impossible look routine. Can the Gaels continue their incredible underdog run and dream the impossible dream? Or will the Golden Hawks send Queens crashing back to reality? Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM at 12:45 p.m. for the Something in the Water pregame show ahead of the 1 p.m. kickoff.
Down the short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge of indie, experimental, post-punk, and electronic, every Wednesday from 10 until 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Get ready to press record.
It's If you enjoy genres like slowcore, post-hardcore, noise rock, math rock, shoegaze, or anything like that, tune into Past Tense 9 p.m. Wednesdays on CFRC. It also airs 9 p.m. Mondays on luradio.ca and 9 p.m. Thursdays on cjlo.com.
You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
Welcome back to another episode of Tech and Talk Podcast. Today we have a very special guest, my grandfather, who is a very interesting person. He's going to give us some rundown in physics and a lot of other kind of aspects of governmental work. So welcome to the podcast, Grandpa.
Thank you.
So we can start off with just, I guess you've done a lot of different work at different universities. And one of them being University of Toronto. Could you tell us just a little bit about your research at UFT?
Yeah, well, I grew up in Victoria, went to Victoria College for 2 years studying physics and math. And then at that time, Victoria College did not have honors physics in third and fourth year. So I went to UBC. And did honors physics there, graduated in 64 and went to University of Toronto in to do a master's in radio astronomy. And then I did a PhD in optical astronomy at the University of Toronto. The radio astronomy, my thesis was on studying the emission of radiation using a radio telescope, the Algonquin radio telescope. And I was trying to understand why we were seeing this particular radiation. There weren't enough stars to generate why we would see that radiation. And as it's now turned out, there's a black hole in the center of our galaxy, and it's producing a large amount of radiation from the area surrounding the black hole. And that's what I had been seeing when I was doing my master's, but I didn't know it at the time. My PhD in optical astronomy was studying the chemistry of various star clusters. I left, I graduated in 69 with a PhD and went to UVic to do a postdoc and got a job offer in the States. So I went to Wheaton College in Northern Massachusetts. But my interests were very strongly in research. So after 3 years, I came back to Canada and joined the Canada Center for Remote Sensing, which was part of the Department of Energy, Mines and Resources at the time. And Canada had a new ground station to receive an American satellite called Landsat. And we had imagery over all of Canada. We didn't know how to analyze it. And so my task was to develop a system that could analyze remote sensing data acquired from aircraft in space. And we built a system called the CCRS Image Analysis System. We designed special processors, and we ended up being able to analyze data 10 times faster than NASA at 1/10 the cost. The reason we went separate from NASA is they refused to share anything with us at that time.
I bet they wished they could share a bit of tech at that point.
That's remarkable.
Well, what they ended up doing, though, was they they decided that maybe we were pretty good at what we were doing, and they suggested we should form a group where we would cooperate and share things. And of course, we were a small organization. We had 120 civil servants and another 150 contractors. A typical NASA center was 20,000 employees. And they were quite open, and they sent us tons of tapes, but we didn't even have the staff to look at all those tapes. So, but we had a good collaboration with NASA, very good. And one of the things they invited me to do was to chair a what was called the Systems Design Review Team for the Large Area Crop Inventory Experiment, LACI. And LACI was a project, huge project, 150 million or so, which in those days was a huge, very large project. And what they were doing was looking at Soviet and Canadian wheat production from space. And they could estimate the accuracy of the grain production to around 90%. And that led to a whole different situation. So imagine you could look at Russia and you could tell to 90% accuracy how much wheat they were going to produce. The thing is, did the Russian information system, was it that accurate? And if it wasn't, yeah, how did you tell them how it is you figured out how much wheat they're going to have? So, you know, I know you guys have an interest in policy, so that's an area where you kind of get a mix of intelligence, but also how much do you reveal of your technology and what you can do. The United States built a secret tracking station in Pakistan to help get better coverage of Russia. And this was all done many years ago. And while it was a large project, and in Canada, of course, we would say, oh, gee, look at what we can do with a much smaller group. The truth is that NASA was a very impressive organization and had some very skilled people. But it also had politicians deal with in the Senate and the Congress. And they said, well, just because you can tell what the wheat production is, how does that help the guy who wants to get bread in the United States? In other words, we can see that it is helping the big grain companies, but how does it help the American taxpayer? And NASA hadn't even thought of how that might help their taxpayers that way. So eventually the LACI program got shut down by Congress. And they stopped doing that monitoring for a while. And then it shifted over to the U.S. Department of Agriculture that has a foreign monitoring group and uses remote sensing technology to look at the agricultural production around the world.
Yeah, so you must have seen quite the progression from like early remote sensing to, I guess, I mean, what it is now, right? With all these new advances in AI and tracking and satellites, it must be a different world.
Well, we, I'll skip ahead and say that years later, we developed an artificial intelligence system. And and AI means many things to many people, but that system, when you have a bunch of computers connecting and you're using the internet to move data from a province, for example, to the federal government and back again, then you have lots of complications. And so we developed what are called expert systems and connected them. And we had about 50 expert systems interconnected. And they would allow us then to analyze remote sensing data and land data from a province to update forest inventory, for example. So that kind of intelligence basically is helping the processing and the flow of data and the results and producing the results automatically. That's not a system that was being driven by voice commands. And in fact, I'll share with you a story. A company made a mapping system that you could command by voice. The company was called Intergraph, and they were located in the States. And the voice commands would allow you to then draw lines on maps and have it become digital and go into the system digitally. But as you were drawing it, you talked to the system and you said you started to say, well, I'm going to draw a line, and the system would respond with the voice command, modify, and you would hear that in your headphones, okay? Now what happened is our staff began to speak like the machine. They began to say, modify, and now the machine didn't recognize her voice.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and so another question. So, like, you did a lot of computer science as well, right? So, like, that was pretty interconnected to what you were doing. How complicated were some of those early programs you were working on? Like, I'm sure it changed a lot from what it is now, but early, like, kind of computer systems.
Well, actually, when I was your age, Kyle, I had a summer job working at the Dominion Observatory in Ottawa, and they had Canada had done aerial photography of the entire country, black and white aerial photography, during the war, and they had all these images and they wanted to see if there were meteor craters, and they were stereo images, and so summer students would look at these images and try and find craters. Now, as it happened, the geologists in Canada at the time didn't believe there were any meteor craters on the planet. And I would be sitting in a room with a bunch of geologists, and whenever I thought I found something that was a crater, they would say, oh, it can't be a crater, it's a volcano, it's a sinkhole, it's a pingo, whatever. And so I learned geology from them, but I also learned that they had a fixed view of the world. So one of the ways to prove you have a meteorite crater is when you find something that's got the right shape, you drill down into it. So you go out in the wilderness and you make a drill and you drill down, you know, thousands of feet, and you discover proof that you have a meteor crater, because when a meteor hits the Earth, it melts the rock. And so you find all the signatures of melted rock. Well, these geologists so strongly believed that there weren't meteorite craters that even one that had been drilled in and proven to be meteorites, they chose to make maps where they called it a volcano. All right, and that was the first time I'd seen somebody making a map and lying about what was really there.
Interesting.
Because of their beliefs. So one of the things in science is it's important to be truthful and to be honest, and therefore to accept that nature may not be telling you what you want to hear. It may be telling you something very different.
What do you think the motivation would be to not, like, believe there's a meteorite there? Or was it just like they just didn't want to accept that?
They were taught in school there were no meteors. Yeah. And of course, anyone who was in astronomy knows there's a lot of meteors. And the moon's got all sorts of craters over it. And every planet we've looked at that's got a solid surface has got meteor craters, right? Mm-hmm. So, today you would never see a geologist do that. In fact, today there are geologists who study the geology of the planets. They're called astrogeologists.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I meant, is astrogeology a relatively new thing that's emerged in the last couple of years?
It came as soon as we started having satellites looking at the Earth. Then now the geologists could look at these same images that I was looking at and look for geological structures, right? Look for fault lines, mm-hmm. and where oil might be a good place to explore for. And then they started using space photography to look at the planets, right? They got an interest in doing things like that, some geologists. And often they were geologists working for NASA. And so now they were trying to interpret, because the geology of the Earth is affected by life, actually. And so when they look at another planet, if it's smaller than the Earth, it might not have as much volcanoes going on. And so its geology might be very different than our planet. If you look at some of the moons of Jupiter, they have frozen methane on them. And that affects the geology of the surface, right? So astrogeologists, it's a very exciting field, but it suffers from one thing that most astronomers have to deal with, is you can't get there, right? I mean, the objects I was looking at for my PhD were far too distant for man to get there by any means. You know, the nearest star is 4 light years away, and with our best technology, it would take 25,000 years to get to that nearest star. And of course, we don't live that long, so you would have to imagine that you had a ship load with enough people on it that you could have a population recycling, and they get there, and there's no habitable planets. Right, so that not too helpful for them. So so next question, fellas.
I
have a question about Starlink. So how do you feel about Starlink? I mean I don't know a huge amount of it about it. All I know is it's kind of like almost like a blanket of like satellites that cover the Earth right now.
Well, a lot of money in telecommunications, and people want to be able to not be limited by geosynchronous satellites. Right? Geosynchronous satellites sit over the equator. So communications companies decided they wanted to use communications with satellites going to various orbits around the planet. And that allowed, if you get enough of them, then you've got total coverage of every point on the planet. And so when you are using your cell phone and everything is working fine, the signals are likely flowing through some satellite in space to where you are.
Yeah, no, it's pretty impressive. I know that you can get a plan on your phone that gives you full cellular reception anywhere on the planet with Starlink. So you could be anywhere and you get full coverage.
Yeah.
That's something. But one thing I was a bit fascinated in is that Canada, from my understanding, at least used to be somewhat of a leader in telecommunications, and it's a little bit different, I guess, in some ways from what we've been speaking about. But do you find that there's been somewhat of a decrease in this type of innovation in Canada over the years, especially more recently? Like Telesat used to be a world leader in satellites, and they're still a world leader, but I don't think their dominance is as prevalent as it used to be.
Well, one of the problems that Canada has is that it has very few scientists that have been elected. And most of the politicians, even the well-meaning ones, don't know much about science. And they don't know about scientists. So, and they don't like advice where it's, you tell them, this is the way it is, not the way they might want it. This is the way it is. And so over my lifetime, I've watched investments in space decline in Canada, not elsewhere, but certainly in Canada. And the Canada Center for Remote Sensing doesn't exist in the same way that it used to. When I joined, it was a research organization, and it was led by a brilliant scientist whose name was Larry Morley. And Dr. Larry Morley discovered seafloor spreading. But one of the experiences he had is he submitted a paper to Nature, and it was sent out to review. And And the reviewers, of course, suggested changes to the paper, and he made the changes. He resubmitted the paper, and it was rejected on the grounds they already had a paper on that topic. That was the British owned the journal, Nature, and that was British people basically stealing the discovery of seafloor spreading from a Canadian so they could claim credit for it.
Is that type of behavior pretty common in the high ends of academia?
It's not even high ends. I was a grad student doing a master's, and another master's student asked me for my help. He didn't know how to write software the way I did. So I wrote him some computing programs and so on that I was going to need in the future myself, and gave it to him, and he graduated. And a year and a half later, I learned that he had put the software in his thesis and claimed it was his.
Wow.
So, yeah, bad players are not just at high levels of organizations. They can also be low levels.
Yeah, yeah, wow. Yeah, definitely. You got to be careful.
One other question I had too, though, if I may, again, sorry, I'll open up the floor to the other guys, but we were doing a bit of research on your profile, and one thing I noticed is that clearly you ended up doing a lot of computing and software engineering to some degree as well. And I have to admit, I'm a little bit unaware and oblivious to all this and its historical development, but what do you think, I guess, was the most significant change in terms of computing and software engineering over the years?
Personal computers were, because the I talked to you about meteor craters, and I was getting really bored looking at these aerial photographs. And my boss, who was a scientist with Energy Mines Resources, said, "Well, I'm going off for a holiday to Europe with my wife, so do whatever you want, kid." So I decided I would try and learn how to program. I knew I was going to be going to grad school, so I learned how to program in Fortran. And so by the time I got to U of T, I was getting pretty good at software. And of course, if you can do a lot of processing of software, you can process a lot more data. And that's how I started to build my software capability. When I came back to Canada for CCRS, my task, I headed a group called the methodology section. And my task was figure out how we can analyze the space data that we're getting. Well, we're collecting thousands of images a day, and clearly we can't analyze it with people looking at them. We have to have some machines to help us. And so we started trying to do it by software on a general purpose computer. And we realized that wouldn't work. The computer wasn't fast enough. So we built a special array processor. We designed and built ourselves. And that allowed us to process data at a much higher speed. Then we really started cranking things out. And we invited the provinces to participate by coming and using our system in the evening. And we provided to them analysts who would help them do the analyzing of the data of their particular province. And that was very successful. And that helped build the knowledge base in Canada of remote sensing analysis, really.
Yeah, no, data has always been the most important thing, right? Just collecting enough data. I have a question about kind of future directions slash kind of predictions from you. So what is like one discovery in physics, like you're kind of still waiting for it to happen, or you kind of see it happening in the future?
Okay, so let me just make a general comment, Kyle, that you can't look at physics separate from the society it's in. Okay. If you want to look at the history of science, you have to also look at the what's going on in that particular country, in that culture. Right? Einstein lived in Germany. And he came up with the idea that with two assumptions. Every observer of the universe sees the universe in the same way, and the speed of light is constant. And with those two postulates, he came up with the special theory of relativity and then the general theory of relativity. And, you know, that's genius, really. So anytime you want to study the science of any science, history of any science, you have to be aware of the environment it was in at the time.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah, to understand like kind of where people are. Makes sense.
Earlier in the interview, though, you mentioned that AI means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But because we do talk about it a decent bit on our podcast, I was wondering what specifically, I guess, would mean for you.
Well, for instance, people like to think that you can just sit and talk to a computer and it's going to understand and so on, okay? I mean, it's still software. And the scary thing about AI, for every computing scientist, I would say, is how do you put moral values into an AI system? Let's suppose a computer system becomes self-aware. We don't know how it might become self-aware, but you could imagine if I said to you, we've interconnected all the computers in the world, and there's no off switch, and they're all communicating, and we don't know what they're communicating about. Well, you should be worried about something like that, because what if it becomes self-aware? And the first thing it's going to decide is, having humans around is a real problem.
Yeah.
Right? So let's get rid of the humans. And if you've given the computer the control of your bombs and your weapons and your ships and everything else, you have a problem for the existence of humanity, right? So most people in computing science that know about AI want to go very slow and want to make sure it isn't a vast interconnected system, that it's a very specific, narrow system.
Yeah, I saw an interesting talk about some people like Sam Altman and some other people that are really important in the AI space. And a lot of people actually think, like, say, ChatGPT, for example, they believe that that is currently sentient. But I think the general consensus from people that do computer science is that it's just really good at mimicking being sentient, but it's not actually sentient. How do you feel about that?
Well, so far nobody's made any intelligent, computing environment.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I think we should be very careful about doing that. So one of the trends in the military is making robots to go off and kill people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the natural progression would probably be implementing AI in some way. I mean, a lot of people are scared about it just because technology is an exponential sort of kind of growth, right? And when, full AGI or sentient AI would be around, could be 5 years, could be 10 years from now, could be 20.
Did you know that Queen's Greenovations can help you save on utilities by helping improve your home's energy efficiency? Greenovations also delivers compost bins to student housing and even does light bulb exchanges. All initiatives are free for students. Learn more and sign up for home retrofits and student compost bin delivery on Instagram at Greenovation.
On Saturday, November 30th, the Independent Wrestling Academy, in cooperation with CFRC 101.9 FM, presents IWA Wrestling School of Rock.
A portion of the proceeds from this family-friendly professional wrestling event will be donated directly to CFRC's annual funding drive. Tickets are available for $20 and can be bought through iwacanada.ca. The event is scheduled to take place at the Upper Hall of the Spire on 82 Sydenham Street. Doors at 5 p.m., opening bell will be at 5:30. Be sure to check out CFRC.ca and IWACanada.ca for additional event details. We hope to see you there, and we hope you're ready to rock the Spire.
What's going on? What are you doing? Tanya, don't ask me.